Coming up on Weekend America.
Sam had put the Korean War behind him until he retired and had time on his hands.
Too much time to think about different things, and I just kept getting deeper and deeper in problems. And like I say now, I feel darn good. Jeez, it's like finding God here.
This Memorial Day weekend, vets turn to their younger comrades for help. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. Also this hour, how Edna Stewart nourished a crusade.
Food brought civil rights workers to her restaurant, and she made a connection with them and, you know, literally fed the movement in Chicago.
Find out how Southern soul food sustains a country and the end of a Renaissance fair.
Don't cry for me, Renaissance fair. The truth is I'm not really Spanish.
Prithee, stay tuned for Weekend America after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, welcome to The Weekend. I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles.
And in St. Paul, I'm Desiree Cooper. This Memorial Day weekend begins a time-honored ritual of summer, abundant eating. In Chicago this weekend, we'll sample some Southside barbecue as we learn how recipes migrated from down south to up north. And then we'll go to Waxahachie, Texas, to the Scarborough Fair, and there you can gorge on roasted turkey legs. And when you're good and full, you can sit with us amongst the Minnesota apple blossoms and dream of the fall harvest when you can start gorging again. What makes a good apple?
Sweetness is a good factor, but I have to have crunch.
Sometimes I like it tart too, so Granny Smith or Royal Gala are my favorites.
I prefer Fuji apples, so a little bit of orange, a little bit of red.
Granny Smith apples that have been sitting for, you know, a couple weeks, so they get that kind of milly. You know, they've aged a little bit.
That's the worst when they're mealy. They should be crunchy.
Fuji. They're huge. They crunch when you bite them, but the flesh underneath is really soft. Kind of like taking a bite out of a hard-boiled cow.
Yes, that's exactly what it's like.
Those voices came from Los Angeles, Ann Arbor, and Portland, Oregon.
This is the show about the American weekend. Don LaFond will be wearing a purple heart this weekend as he attends a Memorial Day ceremony in Los Angeles. He goes every year. Don earned that medal in World War II, the Battle of Saipan. He showed incredible courage, but also fear.
You never know where the bullets are coming from, over here, coming overhead, like mortar shells, bombs, artillery. You're frightened. Anybody said they're not afraid when they're going to combat, they're a liar, you know.
Don is 84 years old, and like many veterans of his generation, he has never been too open with his emotions about the war until recently. Now he talks about his feelings every Friday in a support group, especially for older vets. Weekend America's Chrissy Clark dropped in on them.
It's my pleasure to introduce Donald LaFond. World War II.
Five men sit around a Ray table Derrick, stacked with Oreos and cups of 7-Up.
Sam Zavala.
51 and 52 in Korea.
They're here at
Robert
this Veterans
Adams,
Affairs
Korea.
Clinic in Los Angeles for a group therapy meeting.
And last but by no means least, Joe Medina.
Run by Leslie Martin, the woman who's introducing them.
Second World War.
Every one of these men is old, in his 70s or 80s. Everyone has been to war. And since then, everyone has been living with strange symptoms. Constant nightmares, anxiety, emotional numbness. Most of these men had never given this collection of feelings a name. They've discovered recently it's called post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD.
You know, I'm 84 years old now, and it hasn't, and all this stuff happened to me when I was around in my early 20s. Makes you wonder, you know, gee whiz, if it'll ever leave your mind.
Don LaFond's white hair frames a baby face that hints at what he must have looked like when he first saw combat a half century ago, when he got his Purple Heart.
What I was trying to do was help another Marine. He got hit with a bullet through his mouth and came out by his ear, and I was dragging him back to safety, and that's when I got hit. The bomb went off and caught, the shrapnel caught me right in the stomach. Didn't feel very good, but at the same time, what else could you do, you know?
Don felt proud of what he'd sacrificed for his country. And then, boom, the war was over.
So they just gave me my traveling expenses to get home, and that was about it. And I said, well, I said, what's the story from here? I said, is there anything that I have to know about after I get out? They didn't order, not a thing. So I figured, well, I'm out of the war now. I guess I'll just go home and get a job.
That's what he did. He had a successful career designing aircraft parts, then running a real estate business. But at night, he'd take sleeping pills to try to stop the terrors that jolt him, even now, 63 years later, and wake his wife.
It's very weird, you know, like crazy things happening. Maybe sometimes somebody's trying to do something to you. Bad things are happening.
The VA now estimates that 1 in 20 veterans of World War II, the good war, probably have symptoms like Don's, symptoms of PTSD. The numbers are vague because most older vets were never diagnosed. Back when these men were fighting, the term didn't even exist. Military doctors treated men with so-called battle fatigue only in very extreme cases, which were kept very quiet. For the most part, vets like Don LaFond were expected to be heroic, then stoic. So now, when they come into the VA for routine medical exams and come out with instructions to go to a PTSD support group, they don't quite know how to take it.
All we do is say, why don't you try it?
That's Leslie Martin again. She's the director of PTSD Outpatient Services at the Los Angeles VA and the one who runs the group that Don goes to, the group for older vets.
And here they keep coming, and I have more and more.
Leslie's watched a parade of older men, she calls them her guys, come to see her in the last few years. Across the country, hundreds of thousands of older vets have recently begun seeking treatment for PTSD. And sometimes Leslie asks herself, why now, after all these years? She thinks there are two main triggers. First, retirement. Men who long suppressed their war traumas with work and responsibilities have more time to dwell on old fears. Second,
because we're at war. It's because we're at war. It's in your face everywhere. There are movies about it. It's on television.
So every Friday, here at the Older Vets PTSD Support Group, Leslie tries to help.
And they come in, and there's something about walking in to a group where there are other people clearly from a similar experience. And it's sort of like, where have you been all my life?
The men sit in a circle. Sometimes Leslie will prompt them with questions about how they're feeling. It can get emotional. Like when a man named Sam Zavala starts talking. He served as a machine gunner in Korea. He says before he started coming to this support group 5 years ago, he was having thoughts of suicide.
All the time I was there 9 months in combat. And I was very fortunate to be able to come back, very lucky. It kind of bothered me that I was able to come back and we didn't all come back. I was just one of the lucky ones to come back.
As Sam talks, people in the group nod and listen quietly. When he falters, they nod and listen too.
You come down here and you can talk to the guys and you feel more comfortable because you don't have to go into details. And when you go into details, maybe you lose track of what you really wanted to talk about.
I figure that we're different compared to the regular person that has been in combat.
Joe Medina is 84. A veteran of World War II. He's still a little skeptical about the group. After 60 years of silence, he says it's hard to talk about this stuff.
I never talk about it. Not too many people know that I come to meetings. People think it's a weakness, so I want to be classified as such. Macho thing, I guess.
Joe says he does have fewer nightmares since he started coming to meetings. Don LaFond, the one with the purple heart, wonders out loud if his own will ever stop. Still, Don says he takes every chance he gets to tell younger veterans, ones just coming out of war now, about his group therapy.
At least they know about it. Nobody told me anything, so I want them to know about it.
In Los Angeles, I'm Chrissy Clark for Weekend America.
A New York researcher hopes that veterans of the current wars in Iraq and Afghanistan won't take decades to work through their post-traumatic stress disorder. Maybe the researcher's youth has something to do with her impatience. Ilana Rice is only 16. For the past year and a half, she's been studying how relationships can help heal PTSD. The high school junior hopes that her study is going to shed more light on the disorder. She became interested in the subject through her mother's work as a psychologist in a veterans hospital. I asked Ilana to describe the focus of her study.
Specifically, I'm looking at a partner's attachment style, which is just basically means how an individual reacts in relationships.
So what would be an example of that?
So when you mix a veteran who desperately needs support and you partner that with someone who is not willing to offer that support, it's detrimental to the veteran, and that's what I'm examining.
I think it's interesting that the focus is on relationships and not on the individual, but more how they relate within a relationship.
I've realized that my research is probably more meaningful because it is sending a message when a veteran comes back from PTSD. It's essential that you understand how you're receiving them and what you are doing to help them or what you might actually be doing to hurt them.
Alana, why are you interested in PTSD?
When I was younger, my mom is actually a VA psychologist, so that's why I've become so passionate about post-traumatic stress disorder and combat veterans. I used to send them Veterans Day cards every year, and some of them saw these cards and they offered to meet me, and so I've known some of them for many years, and when I got older, they would share their stories with me.
Has your mom helped you at all with your research?
My mom hasn't really been able to help me out that much because of her job. There are ethics issues with that. So I think the best thing that she's done is be someone who can sympathize how passionate I am about this research. And I think that's more valuable than just finding me a subject here or there.
How hard has it been to find people to fill out the questionnaire?
That has been the single most difficult part of this project. I think it's a lot of it has to do with the fact that I am a high school student. My resources are not that extensive. I'm really working with a lot of local organizations. When it comes to actually finding people, originally I was looking only at the most current Iraq and Afghanistan veterans, and there are simply not enough of them to fill out a questionnaire so that my study would be valid and that my data would be accepted. So I had to expand it to include Vietnam vets, veterans of the Korean War, Desert Storm, as well as the two most recent conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan. And it's also very difficult to find people who have non-veteran romantic partners who are married to or living with them. Sometimes these partners don't want to fill out the survey.
Ilana, what do you hope to accomplish through your research?
Well, I think probably the biggest benefit would be that my research somehow leads to the development of couple therapies in order to help prevent or treat post-traumatic stress disorder.
Alana, this has been wonderful. Good luck on your research.
Thank you for allowing me on your show.
To participate in Ilana's study, you can go to our website, weekendamerica.org. Some 300,000 Afghanistan and Iraq war veterans have been diagnosed with PTSD, and experts predict that millions more from World War II, Korea, and Vietnam will join them in the coming years.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week. And by Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Tables, How to Eat Supper, the latest cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat.
Coming up, a reversal at a polygamist ranch, the dollar discriminates against the blind, and paying to check your luggage. Good news, bad news, or no news, next on Weekend America.
Thank you.
From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. It's time to sort out our feelings about the week's news. We ask a panel of well-meaning non-experts to think about whether the week's events have been good news, bad news, or no news, because it's not always obvious. You're about to disagree with someone, maybe all of them, so enjoy that disagreement. It's the beginning of a conversation. Conversing with us this week, our New Yorker cartoon editor, Bob Mankoff. Welcome back, Bob.
Pleasure to be here.
Yale University literature professor, Amy Hungerford. Hello, Amy.
Hi, Bill.
And political consultant, Tara Settmayer. Hey, Tara.
How are you?
Excellent, thank you. Our first topic, a Texas appeals court says the state should return those 400 children to their polygamist Mormon ranch. The judges said the state did not show enough evidence of physical danger to warrant removing the kids without a court hearing. Is the ruling good news, bad news, or no news?
I think this is good news for the rule of law. It's important that the law can distinguish between individuals in a fairly accurate and specific way, and it seems like that's exactly what this case didn't do, the prosecutor's case didn't do. And so I think it's important to protect these young girls, but you really have to make sure that you are taking away the right kids.
I agree. It's good news for the rule of law. That's exactly what I was going to say. But it's bad news for these children. You know, it demonstrates really the dysfunction of child protective services, not only in Texas, but the child protection services system is broken across the country.
I think it is the sort of good news in a way, because I really can't understand why you can't have polygamy. And in a way, the prejudice, if you will, against polygamy is somewhat like the prejudice against same-sex marriage. I mean, the children aside, okay, let's say the children were not an issue and that you have to be over a certain age and stuff, people would still say, hey, I don't like it because it's strange, or they're not used to it, or they think that marriage or whatever it is should be this one particular thing.
We wouldn't have laws against it in that case. I mean, I think you're right, Bob, that, you know, even though it's distasteful to some people, it's hard to imagine a legal reason why it
why
can't.
Consenting adults
right.
Could not, you know, have this type of relationship. And it's not like it's historically unknown. I mean, it's in the Bible. Didn't so-and-so have 22 wives? And it's not even against
Solomon.
Sort of the Judeo-Christian background. So it's, you know, it's, I mean, I think it's our prudishness, actually.
My guests are Brigham Young and Joseph Smith. Our next topic. A federal appeals court says the U.S. discriminates against blind people by printing paper money that makes it impossible for them to tell a 5 from a 50. The ruling could force the Treasury to redesign bills to be different sizes or have raised markings on them. Is this ruling good news, bad news, or no news?
Bad news for me in cartoons.
Oh?
We're discriminating, clearly. We obviously need Braille cartoons.
Ah, yeah.
Ah.
I think Braille money is good. My other ideas are smell money. Mm-hmm. 100 smells like fine leather and $1 smells like the subway. And it just money just really huge, like when you win the lottery, like $100 bill, just enormous. And
yes.
Everyone will feel good about that.
I think it's good news for the blind and for the sighted, because I'm really hoping that this will be an occasion to make our money a lot better looking. Really, it's embarrassing when you go to England and you see how beautiful their money is.
I'm embarrassed when I go to England because of my accent.
Uh-huh.
The money I don't care about.
It seems problematic to me that with the brain trust we have in Washington, D.C., in theory, that someone hasn't come up with this sooner. You mean to tell me no one thought of the concept of, well, let's do something to make this more disabled friendly? I just don't understand. But then again, it just shows you how bureaucratically inert most of our people in Washington are anyway.
Our next topic. Airlines are suffering under high oil prices. Now American Airlines says it will start charging passengers $15 to check one bag, $25 more for a second bag. Does that sound like good news, bad news, or no news?
This is awful, awful news for civility in travel. It's like a bad marriage where every consideration has to be paid for in some way. And it means that there is no forgiveness on either side of this equation. And the miscalculation here is that the airlines are asking travelers to pay a little extra for every single little consideration that they get, but they're failing to deliver the one thing that they remain responsible for, which is a flight at a certain time from A to B. And this is going to make problems.
I mean, I think it's good news, actually, just for all the people who pack too much and don't need all that stuff. But for the people who want to get around it, I imagine like the equivalent of like clothing mules, like drug mules, swallowing it in balloons.
Yes. Swallow your
and
socks.
And just, you know, just get, they'll get it around it one way or the other.
Listen, you know what? This is bad news. This is a PR nightmare for the airlines. Like, yeah, they don't have enough problems. But, I mean, where do they draw the line with this? Are they going to start charging now for cleaner oxygen in the front as opposed to the back? I mean, it's absurd.
I think they're going to start charging you for flying inside the plane.
They're going to start charging us for seatbelts. Well, you know, if you want a seatbelt, it's going to cost you an extra $50.
Some passengers say it's good news because you're in control. If you pack light, you save money.
Yeah, but see, everyone's just going to be having a fight over the overhead storage space in the cabin. And as I say, civility is going to be the big loser here.
I don't think there's much civility left.
It's true.
Our last topic. This weekend, Indiana Jones fans get to see their favorite action hero played by a 65-year-old man. Is that good news, bad news, or no news?
Well, being in his demographic,
yeah,
I would have preferred it to be Indiana Jones and, like, the Temple of Reduced Healthcare. You know, the critical moment where he gets the knee replacement.
Yes. The copay is rolling down the hill toward him.
I think the movie itself is kind of bad news for the old, because it's a bad model of late life. It's become a parody of itself, and that's the last thing you want to be as an older person, a parody of yourself, just sort of recapping all the things you used to do and doing them again in a very predictable way.
There are some gags, apparently, about Indiana getting older.
Well, I mean, listen, must we have a geopolitical statement for any time we have an American hero in a movie? It's a movie. In the Bible, it says, laughter does good like medicine. Relax. If it's funny, let it be funny. I just think that people are overanalyzing the whole
Bible,
thing.
Boy, the Bible's not a big fan of laughter. It's like Sarah laughed and she was set upon by jackals.
Who sound like they're laughing, but they're actually about to eat you.
Ironically.
Ironically set upon by jackals. Yeah. Which actually made it sort of funny.
Yeah. A lot of irony in the Bible. That's the news this week. Panel, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
Political consultant Tara Settmeyer, Yale Lit Prof Amy Hungerford, and New Yorker cartoon editor Bob Mankoff. Okay, now we have a question for you. This is yearbook season across the country. Some of us are still living with that pithy phrase we thought was so clever and so deep that it just had to be next to our yearbook photo.
Exactly. My son gave this fantastic quote for his high school yearbook. Only problem is it came from O.J. Simpson.
That's
not
unfortunate.
Good.
What quote lives forever beside your yearbook picture? How and why did you choose it? Do you regret it? Please share your story with us at www.weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This program is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, and KPCC Los Angeles.
Birds do it. Bees do it, and this weekend, even apple trees are doing it, giving birth to the best apples on earth, coming up on Weekend America.
Thank you.
From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm Desiree Cooper with Bill Radke. The new Indiana Jones movie is out this weekend. Now, Indy has taught the world what it really takes to be an archaeologist. First, always carry a bullwhip.
Good advice. Also, avoid German National Socialists.
Nazis. I hate these guys.
And whenever possible, leave your family at home.
Where's my father?
In the belly of that steel beast.
Dad! Junior!
Okay, so that's the motion pictures. Our next guest is an actual archaeologist. Rebecca Graff is at the University of Chicago, and she and a team of 20 undergrads are now digging up Chicago's Jackson Park to find ancient artifacts from the World's Fair of 1893. Rebecca, the Indiana Jones movie opens wide this weekend. How much of that series have you seen?
Oh, I've seen all of it.
Yeah?
Definitely.
And that's exactly what being an archaeologist is like,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. No, we keep joking, you know, that we haven't found a crystal skull and we really don't expect to.
Where are you right now? What can you see?
Well, I'm actually sitting right by the Museum of Science and Industry. It has a connection to the fair because it used to be the Fine Arts Palace of the World's Columbian Exposition, and it was rebuilt from those plans in the 20s to become the Museum of Science and Industry.
Why are you working on the south side of Chicago, Rebecca, instead of the Peruvian jungle?
I think that Chicago has so much interesting stories to tell, and that I hope that this project will make people even more interested in what we can talk about in terms of Chicago, in terms of the growth and development of American cities, in terms of America's industrial past and present, and do some more projects.
What are you hoping to find? What would be your holy grail, the Ark of the Covenant of this excavation?
Well, I guess we don't really have a holy grail, but we joke that one of the fathers of anthropology was actually here, of American anthropology, Franz Boas. He came here to put an exhibit together that actually became the founding collections of the Field Museum. And we keep joking that it would be really fun if we found Franz Boas's pocket watch somewhere on the site.
What's the most fascinating artifact to you personally that you have found?
If I had to talk about something that I thought was actually very pretty or aesthetically pleasing, I do like the mineral water bottles. They're very pale aqua glass. A lot of them have this blob top. They don't have, the sort of bottle caps that we have now. That wasn't the technology being used. You know, people still drink mineral water and think there's certain health benefits associated and there's certain status associated with drinking it. And it's interesting to think about these consumer practices in America that are still with us today that maybe started 100 or more years ago.
And when you're holding that bottle, what's going through your mind?
Well, I have a sort of a personal connection to the fair that I found out about after I had already started working on this project, which was that my great-grandfather had gotten a job in 1892 as a laborer on the fair digging ditches on the Midway. It was just very interesting to think that my family was here at the same time, in some senses doing similar jobs as far as actually moving dirt.
Are the Nazis trying to stop you?
No. I think that the Canada geese are probably our biggest problem right now.
Yeah? How's that?
Oh, they're interested in what we're doing, or we're trying to not bother them.
What is being an archaeologist really like?
I don't think it's quite as maybe as sexy as the Indiana Jones part, because you're not out in the field all the time. So much of the research takes place before and after the field work. A lot of it is reading and writing and researching, both before and after. So I don't think Indiana did that much.
He had a very flexible job, Indiana Jones.
Yes, he certainly did. He got to travel a lot, too.
Yeah, he was on sabbatical pretty much all the time.
His teaching load was much lighter than it seems to be for a lot of academic archaeologists here.
Well, Rebecca, good luck avoiding rolling boulders and any other problems. I hope your face doesn't melt off. Thanks for joining us, and good luck with your excavation.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
You're a teacher?
Part-time.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
Welcome to The Weekend. I'm Desiree Cooper with Bill Radke. Researchers at the University of Minnesota have been breeding apples for 100 years. They developed the Honeycrisp a little over 30 years ago. In just the past 3 years, it's become a consumer favorite. Well, the patent on this apple expires this fall, and that means a big loss of income to the university. So this weekend, the university's apple breeders, including David Bedford, are busy cross-pollinating trees. They're trying to come up with an even more perfect apple. I went to visit David, and I asked him what he looks for in an apple.
In our breeding program, there's two things that we're most concerned about, texture and flavor. And in my mind, that's what really separates good apples from the world of mediocre apples, which there's plenty of out there.
What makes Honeycrisp apples so good?
Basically, crispness. When you bite into it, you get this, what we call explosively crisp.
Wow, and explosive, huh?
Explosively crisp, yeah. Yeah, eat at your own risk. And really, to get the best sensation of a Honeycrisp, you need to bite into an intact apple. Now, this apple I'm going to give you is over 7 months old. So
whoa.
There's not too many apples that I'd feel
But it looks beautiful. I mean, the color is gorgeous, and it doesn't look all dimply the way apples start to look when they get older?
Yeah, that's true. It does have a good appearance, although I have to say that I've been fooled by lots of apples in the grocery store that look pretty good and don't have much inside.
All right, so what are the chances this is not going to taste that good?
Well, I think it's, I'm going to let you, I think it's pretty good.
All right,
yeah. Considering its age, I think you'll be impressed.
Did you bring an extra napkin up here?
Yeah. I always say it's best to eat a Honeycrisp with a bib on. Mm-hmm. It's so juicy that you're going to have some drippage almost certainly.
Well, it's actually quenching, you know, that it's sweet.
And that's another thing we look for in an apple. We want it to have a combination of sweet and tart.
So you've already created the perfect apple. So what are you doing now during breeding season?
Well, I can't take all the credit for Honeycrisp by any means. I'm just sort of the part of the team that has been working for 100 years, actually, at the University of Minnesota on apple breeding. But what we're doing right now is the early stages of making crosses for this year. And crosses really basically involve taking the pollen from one variety and putting it onto the flowers of another. You know, when you find those good ones, you say, "Boy, I think this one maybe does have potential to be a Honeycrisp type," and then you hold your breath.
So, can you take me to your secret garden where the new apples are being cultivated?
Well, I think we could. I might have to blindfold you and spin you around a few
okay.
times, but yeah, we can do that.
All right, let's go.
Okay.
Whoa, it's windy out on this hill.
Yeah, this is sort of what we deal with in spring in Minnesota. And it doesn't make breeding always the easiest, but it's not the worst of all our problems. Now, this tree that we're coming up to actually is our oldest Honeycrisp tree. It's not the original tree. The original tree is gone now, but this was the first tree propagated from the original. So it's over 30 years old.
And have you propagated it so that the blood will live on, so to speak?
Yep. In fact, all the Honeycrisp trees in the country, in the world right now, started from this tree.
So how do you keep the bees from pollinating the flowers when they bloom?
Yeah, that's a good question because, in fact, without bees, we wouldn't have apples in most cases. So we definitely need that pollination. But, of course, bees have no idea what pollen they're bringing with them. So in our case, when we want controlled pollination, we put a little waxed bag. I don't know, it always reminds me sort of an old bakery bag, you know, that you get French loaves in or something. Put this bag over the top. Fold it a couple times in our little special fold here and put a staple right on the end of it like that. Now, in a week or so when the blossoms have opened, we'll come back and take that off. We'll apply the pollen onto the flowers and we found out that the best way to apply that pollen is just with the tip of our fingers.
Oh, this seems amazingly low-tech. This whole thing.
Yeah, you're right. We're basically doing what the bees have done for thousands of years, and the only difference is that we choose what pollen we use.
Well, David, thank you for the tour.
Oh, my pleasure.
David let me taste apple variety number 2037, a cross between Honeycrisp and Snow Sweet apples. It had this snappy texture and kind of a rosy taste. During the harvest, David tastes 500 to 600 apples every day.
And over in Illinois this weekend, people are sampling the southern flavor of Chicago. The event is called Camp Chicago, an Up South Expedition. So there will be grilling and soul food tasting and conversation. What does the story of food say about the American story? At the turn of the century, African Americans moved out of the South looking for opportunities in the urban North. The so-called Great Migration was about the movement of people, but also culture. Amy Evans is an oral historian with the Southern Foodways Alliance at the University of Mississippi in Oxford. She went to Chicago in March to collect stories from Southern food restaurant owners. Amy, welcome to Weekend America.
Thank you, Bill. I'm glad to be here.
Amy, we can't talk about Southern food without talking about barbecue. What did you find out about the Great Barbecue Migration?
James Lemons of Lem's Barbecue, he is a native of Indianola, Mississippi, and grew up on a farm with his family, and they would have hog killings every year. So he and his brothers, had an intimate relationship with hogs, and once they got to Chicago, they went back to that so they could be small business owners and, work for themselves and do something that they knew and loved.
Let's hear from James Lemons.
When we came to Chicago, we started working in a restaurant. Well, mostly that was the most jobs was out then. Then the war came, came along. So a lot of people went to the factories. My brother and I stayed in the cooking business. Then years later, my younger brother came along. They opened up a barbecue place. I came in on it late on.
And what did you find out about how Southern food has changed as it's moved north?
Really, that just depends on the individual, how they've changed something or used a different ingredient that they found in the city. One example is Isola White, who has Isola's Family Dining on 79th Street in Chicago. She took the South with her and opened a soul food restaurant on the south side of Chicago. She did leave something behind, and that was yellow cornmeal. Her corn muffins are made specifically with white cornmeal, and she talks about that in her interview.
I never did like yellow cornmeal because that's all we had down south. When you're in the south and you don't have no money, you get the corn and you take it to the gin, and they ground it up, make it into yellow cornmeal. That's what we had. I never liked it from that day on.
What did that say to you, that here was someone purposely turning away from what she grew up with?
It's really complicated. I mean, a lot of displaced Southerners still have a connection to their home place, whether it be through family reunions or, relatives still there or just going back to visit the place from which they came. But Isola was a standout. While she opened a soul food restaurant, she really wanted to cut ties with her memories and experiences from the South.
You also spoke with the owner of a Chicago soul food restaurant who grew up in Chicago. It was her parents who moved north. Her name is Edna. What has Southern food meant to her?
Well, Edna Stewart's story, Edna Stewart is the owner of Edna's restaurant on West Madison Street in Chicago on the west side. And she, as you said, is a native Chicagoan. Her parents were sharecroppers in Covington, Tennessee. Really, she and her restaurant are an icon of the civil rights movement in Chicago.
Let's hear that clip from Edna Stewart.
One day in the restaurant, it was a white girl and a black guy, and they had on jeans. And in 1966, we didn't see too many jeans, okay? And we didn't see a mixed racial couple on Madison Street. And so they would come in and they would say, oh, that looks good. So finally they would probably have a piece of cornbread and some syrup. And they would stay probably 3-4 hours, every day they would come in. He said, would you like some more customers? I said, certainly I would love some more customers. But he didn't tell me that he was one of the Scouts for Dr. King's organization. And that's how everybody started, Reverend Jesse Jackson and Dorothy Tillman and Reverend Bernard Lee. So that's how I got the civil rights workers.
Food brought civil rights workers to her restaurant. She made a connection with them and supported them and you know, literally fed the movement in Chicago. And when in 1968 Dr. Martin Luther King was killed and there were riots in Chicago, the entire neighborhood around her was devastated and many buildings on her block burned to the ground. But Edna's survived. The restaurant survived.
Amy, what have you learned about the future of Southern food outside the South?
Everyone I ask across the board, I ask, you know, what is the future of your business or your restaurant? And so many people don't have an answer. They don't know. Their children aren't interested or their grandchildren aren't interested. And there's also an evolution of Southern food, you know, Southern food and its popularity is being adapted in all different kinds of ways. And you see a lot of white tablecloth restaurants, you know, having greens and a duck cassoulet at a five-star restaurant.
Amy, thank you so much for the conversation.
Thank you, Bill, for having me.
Amy Evans is an oral historian with the Southern Alliance Foodways. We have a wonderful slideshow for you, complete with narration. It's the creation of a Southern three-layer caramel cake.
Oh, man.
And it's a good thing you have a three-day weekend to tackle this thing. See what you are getting into and enjoy the sweetness at weekendamerica.org.
Get all of your outdoor eating done today, Chicago. Thunderstorms are going to be migrating across the skies for much of the Memorial Day weekend. For more weather, here's Week in America's Brendan Noonan.
How many hipsters does it take to screw in a light bulb?
How many?
You mean you don't know? Expect cool detachment, the aforementioned hipsters, and a few showers this weekend at the Sasquatch Music Festival in George Washington. The temperatures will be in the 60s, but with headliners R.E.M., The Flaming Lips, and The Cure, the vibe will be in the late 80s, or early 90s. The Ohio College of Podiatric Medicine is having their Glass Slipper Fete in Cleveland this weekend. That's a large, elaborate party for those of you who aren't up on your Middle English. It's going to be sunny and in the 60s. Say, if they pass a resolution that condemns high heels, would that be considered a fête? Fairy tales can come true in Loves Park, Illinois, where they're having the Young at Heart Festival. It's going to be partly cloudy and 74 degrees. For those of you who prefer to be old of heart, head to the concession stands where they offer heart-friendly foods like cheddar nuggets, chili brats, mozzarella sticks, and pork chop sandwiches. For information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm Brendan Noonan for Weekend America.
Part entertainment, part living history, and some bosoms and mead. Come to the Renaissance Fair next on Weekend America.
Weekend America is supported by the Fetzer Institute as part of its campaign for love and forgiveness, online at loveandforgive.org.
From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. Welcome to Memorial Day weekend. You might get to play this weekend, or you might have to work, or both if you are a performer at a Renaissance fair, spelled F-A-I-R-E. These weekend reenactments of old Europe have gotten really popular the last few decades. One of the fairs, the Scarborough Renaissance Festival, south of Dallas, ends on Monday. Years ago, Weekend America's Julia Barton was going to Scarborough Fair every weekend in the spring. Her parents played there in a music group called Earthly Pleasures. The band is not together now, but some of the same national acts are still at the festival, and Julia went back to see if much has changed.
A little before 10 on Saturday morning, Doug Konjolka starts his workday.
We're going outside the front gate. We've been inside now, so I will have to talk very differently when I get out there. I'll talk like this all the time. And there'll be people out here waiting to say hello to us, and we'll say hi to the king and queen.
Doug will spend the weekend as Miguel Rodrigo Jesus Alfredo Esteban de Zaragoza, a 16th century Spanish servant and campy buffoon.
Hola. Buenos días.
Buenos días, Miguelito.
You're going to have fun today? Come see us?
We're here again. Last year we were here. We're here again this year.
Excellent. 11 o'clock, first show. I think I'm going to become a woman at 3:30. I'm not sure yet.
Oh, that's right. I heard you did that cross-dressing on weekends. That's
yeah, only on weekends.
Scarborough Fair is set in 1533, during the reign of Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn. The king and queen stand between some turrets above the customers, called patrons, who've paid $20 apiece to enter the fair today. I remember Doug from 24 years ago when he and his partner first started doing their sword fighting, whip trick, and comedy shtick here. Don Juan and Miguel are still freakishly the same, still chopping up pasta with a whip.
Now one final cut, very difficult. One final cut, the bunny cut. The ears of the bunny. Cut this ear and not that ear, master.
You know, if I cut that one ear, I can sell it for a dollar. It'll be a buccaneer.
Not that I ever hung out with the likes of Don Juan and Miguel. I was intimidated by the national acts. As a teenager, I thought renfairs were all about knowing when to say in sooth and anon and calling balloons bladders and cameras Flemish painters. Don Juan and Miguel could care less. Their act is more Comedy Central than Shakespeare.
Don't cry for me, Renaissance Fair. The truth is I'm not really Spanish. I'm just a Polack who's from Chicago. And like Janet Jackson, here is my nipple.
Audiences love them. Also body acts like Zilch the Tory Steller, purveyor of crude spoonerisms.
This left Ransom homie all frilly restrated. Yeah, Sweden ho goat. Ooh, he spent the nest of the right wanging out by her hindo.
Terrence Foy has been working the Renfair circuit even longer than Don Juan and Miguel, starting in Minnesota so long ago.
So long, I'll walk out on stage, there's an audience already assembled, walk out on stage and they go, wow, you gained weight. Oh, thank you. Boy, you got gray. I know, you have too.
Terry has seen Renaissance fairs go from one-weekend deals with card tables in a parking lot to multi-million-dollar entertainment empires. Life backstage has changed, too.
So this is the Junk now?
This is the Junk.
Oh, my God.
The Junk is a pub in the off-site performers' campground.
It's so sophisticated.
This is no longer the flood-prone, poison-ivy-infested backwoods that I remember. Not only is there a real bar, they have a greenhouse and a playground, and row after row of campers.
Master bedroom. There's a bathroom in there.
Very nice.
Yeah, as far as I'm concerned, this is a $30,000 bathroom because you get tired of the little plastic houses after a while and having a shower all by yourself. What a fabulous thing.
It took Terry Foy 3 decades to acquire luxuries like an RV. He just turned 50, and so far he has no plans to ease up. Nobody here does.
Until they stop hiring me. I don't know. I'll work forever.
That's Jose Granados, the whip-cracking swordsman half of Don Juan and Miguel. He's 53, has a bad knee, a sewn-up lip, and several small scars on his hands from years of doing his show.
I believe that I can do what I do, especially the whip and stuff like that, for forever, you know? I mean, and the sword fights will probably get a little slower, but we can compensate either hopefully with more humor or with better timing or, you know what I mean, more precision. As opposed to just wildness and jumping around the stage.
Don Juan and Miguel have slowed down, but no one seems to notice. And in truth, they don't look much older than when I saw them as a teenager. It's both weird and weirdly reassuring to know that every weekend morning in spring, after Scarborough Fair begins, Miguel Rodrigo Jesus Alfredo Esteban de Zaragoza can be found inside the gates blowing up a balloon.
Everyone's coming in now. I'm going to go play my Bladivarius.
But timelessness is, of course, what we want in a Ren Fair. In Scarborough Fair's version of 1533, Anne Boleyn has never died. The wonder and cruelty of the New World are still far off, and so are the burdens of democracy and modern technology. The music sounds the same as when my parents played here, and Doug Konjolka can always make a living wearing red and black velvet and rubbing a bladder. The future will take care of itself. In Waxahachie, Texas, I'm Julia Barton for Weekend America.
The Scarborough Fair will pull up stakes in Waxahachie after this weekend, closing until next spring, so these performers will go off and play other Ren fairs around the country.
You know, that seems like a tough way to make a living.
Yes, yes it does, and there's no pension fund waiting for them either when they ever do retire from being Bladivarius. They're independent contractors. They have this informal insurance system. It's called RESCUE, Renaissance Entertainers, Services, and Crafters United. And at every festival, the performers raise money to help pay the medical bills of Ren Faire workers in need.
Yeah, all that jousting does add up.
That's true. You can only play Drench a Wench and Soak a Bloke so many times before it takes its toll. You can feast upon Scarborough Fair visually when you come to our website, weekendamerica.org. That's it for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America, produced by Ben Adair, Julia Barton, Jim Gates, Millie Jefferson, E. Okobi, who's kite flying this weekend, Philip Stern, Sam Keenan, Michael Rayfield, Tim Bomba, and Angela Kim.
Also, Rob Byers, Susie Lechtenberg, Michael May, who's camping, kayaking with his wife, friends, and a dog at the Lower Colorado River this weekend. There's Chrissy Clark, Brendan Noonan. David Banks is going to Santa Cruz to see his stepbrother perform in a high school musical, Urinetown. Good luck with that. Also, Phyllis Owens, John Moe, and Mark Sanchez.
Galactic created our theme music. Our executive producer is Peter Clowney. Jim Russell created the show, and you can get a free podcast of it at weekendamerica.org. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. Have a wonderful Memorial Day weekend.
Weekend America is supported by Gather.com, where people can stay in touch with who they know and what they love. You can discover unsigned musicians, discuss books, share pictures, and keep up with the world. People are talking. Gather.com. This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul. And made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
Hi, I'm Desiree Cooper, co-host of Weekend America. The weekends are for freedom.
Our job is to liberate them from the sensibilities and the conventions of their day-to-day life.
Now I just walk down the street and I'm like Mary Poppins. I'm free as a bird.
Forget the chores, the errands, and the weekend runaround. Liberate yourself with Weekend America, where great radio lives on the weekend.